This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, toss a coin to your fantasy authors when epic fantasy hits the screen.
And this week, we would like to apologise for reminding you all of that one song which you probably have just finally got out of your head.
Also, let's add the caveat that this week we are going to be in spoiler city. So if you don't want to be spoiled by your big epic fantasy things like Game of Thrones, although we know which rock were you living under that you haven't got there already, The Witcher, which you may not have watched yet, then you might want to avoid this episode and come back next week. But otherwise, because it's going to be too difficult to talk around all the spoilers, so we're just going to go for it.
This is going to be spoiler city, guys.
So, why this episode, ultimately? Largely, I think it's kind of my fault, because I watched The Witcher over Christmas, and then I was nagged Madeleine mercilessly, like, you must watch The Witcher. I need you to watch it so I can talk to you about it. No, I need you to watch it so we can talk about it on Dissecting Dragons.
Yeah. I put it off for as long as was conceivably possible.
It's like, why were you doing that to yourself?
Honestly, because I had so much work to do and I knew that if I started, that was going to be me. Because I was introduced to The Witcher when I was about 20? No, maybe it was 19. And I read some of the books and I just kind of, I really, really enjoyed it. And I kept seeing all these great things about the series and I was like, okay, I've kind of got to, I know that I'm going to become obsessed with it. I also, however, had a slightly claustrophobic feel when it came to The Witcher, because what happened was I created a character a while back. I was super proud of this character. I really, really liked them. And then I read some of The Witcher and I was like, God damn it! They're really similar!
That's just one of those things, isn't it?
It is, and like a lot of the circumstances were similar. I was like, people are just going to think that I completely ripped this off.
Yeah.
And so I got really super panicky about it. So for a while I kind of avoided Witcher things, because I was like, I don't want to accidentally be influenced. I don't want to... it just made me super panicky. Even though I actually really enjoyed The Witcher, as a series, and I read The Last Wish, and I read a little bit of some of the other books, and I was very familiar with the lore and stuff like that. So I did eventually kind of sit down and go, right, I'm going to watch this. And naturally I fell in love. So
yes, it is incredibly compulsive. Right, so... Basically, it's why is everybody losing their shit over this? It's not just The Witcher, it's things like Game of Thrones. Those are hardly the only two examples of epic fantasy that have hit the screen. Obviously, way back in the day when I was about 1920, it was Lord of the Rings, which was a huge thing at the time, to have something that immersive and that huge. And I think ultimately we keep getting a little bit closer with every series that comes out that sort of hits these tropes and really goes all out on creating the world and everything. We get just a little bit closer, and it's really exciting for those of us who are basically genre proles, who really, really like imbibing our story in the format of science fiction or fantasy, to have something put out there that's actually valuable and not just, you know, cheesy special effects, poor storyline, poor characterization, just a thin veil for, you know, the new version of a Western or what have you. And it's I think for so long it was kind of denigrated to being sort of the lowbrow form of entertainment. Genre books were sort of like, didn't require a lot of effort. They didn't, no one really talked about the language that was used in them, and the fact that the prose could be incredibly beautiful as well, or that they're incredibly intricate and a lot of them are very intelligent and deliver amazing themes. And it was a case of, I don't really want to pick on literary fiction, but there was a lot of, oh, you read fantasy, you read the popular stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It's the politics of books and reading, unfortunately. So actually seeing it starting to make its way onto the screen is amazing.
I completely agree. And it's actually, it hasn't just opened up avenues in terms of popularizing fantasy and making it more of a universal, less of a nerd thing. It's added a prestige to it to the extent that actually things which are typically nerdy are now incredibly popular. Things like Dungeons and Dragons, for instance, you know, yeah. RPG games and stuff like that. And I think that there, we can't really actually necessarily talk about fantasy and the way that it's sort of risen up on the screen without at least briefly mentioning also the contribution that video games has made to that movement as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So things like Skyrim and things like the Witcher games as well, which are also obviously incredibly popular.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I think that was my introduction to the Witcher, was the fact that I sort of got two different sources at the same time. Alan was playing the Witcher games and I just haven't had time to get into them. Certainly, he has actually said you could skip the first two and just go straight for the Wild Hunt. He said, because that's by far the most superior. And then I realised that actually I'd read a couple of books from the series and I was thinking, hang on, is that the same white-haired dude from those books I read a while back?
It is.
And I was like, oh, wow, this looks really good. And it is so amazingly well done, the video games as well.
Yeah.
So, and I understand there's going to be an anime series and there's Witcher graphic novels. So,
wait, there's going to be an anime series?
Yeah. Yeah, there is.
The Witcher?
Yeah, it's going to focus on Geralt's mentor. Is it Visimir? Visimir, something like that?
Visimir, yeah.
Yeah, so that's coming to Netflix at some point in the near future.
I did not know that.
Which would be kind of cool. So, I mean, I don't think it's just down to the author. This is a case of the author's created something that is multidimensional and fits across various different media and platforms. So, you know, hats off there. But then all these people love it, and it's been this cult thing sort of going for the last sort of 10 years or so. And you have to applaud that, because the author, Andrzej Sapkowski, sorry, my Polish is not good, is actually a Polish author, and it's actually quite difficult to break into the global mainstream of entertainment if you're not actually an English speaker, you know, native. Yeah. So, yeah, it's quality. It's got something that captures the imagination, and we're going to go into more of why that is a bit later.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I do think that the video game is a large part of why we have this content to begin with. So, as I said, we can't really talk about it without also, you know, acknowledging the way that video games have contributed to the rising of the genre. I mean, I know for a fact that there are several Game of Thrones video games now as well.
Yeah, I've not tried them, so I can't comment, but...
No, but it just seems now that... You almost can't really have a major fantasy series without there being some kind of equivalent video game. There's Harry Potter video games. There's Harry Potter several games, obviously. And then there's obviously Lord of the Rings has got video games. You just can't. The two seem to be quite intrinsically tied.
It is true, and it's a timely reminder that as an author, you should try and hold on to as many of your subsidiary rights as possible, or your agent should be doing so. Otherwise, you won't see a lot of money from their sale.
Yes.
So that sort of brings us on to looking at how epic fantasy is formed before it obviously goes on to become any sort of TV series or film or what have you. And my theory, and it's not especially original theory, is that epic fantasy in particular seems to come from three different sources. Number one, it comes from the pre-existing understanding of fantasy. So J.R.R. Tolkien has an awful lot to answer for there. Admittedly, he was leaning on the fantasy in the form of myths and legends from sort of Scandinavia and from Europe and probably Poland and things as well. So,
yeah.
And other sources, you can have the historically inspired fantasy. History, as we've said before, is a rich resource for anyone who's world building for fantasy because it already exists. It's in people's minds and zeitgeist as something that's already there. So the amount of world building you do, you've already got the skeleton, the scaffolding is there. There are obviously downsides to this, but you can essentially write a historical fiction set in a fantasy world and add dragons and things to it, which is pretty much what George R. R. Martin did with yes. Game of Thrones. And then the final one is one I don't see quite as much of, and I think this is why The Witcher particularly captured me, and that is fantasy which is based and draws its themes from the original darker versions of fairy tales.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we are now seeing a resurgence in the fascination with fairy tales, which are kind of contributing to fantasy. But it is true that The Witcher has this very unique take on it. And again, I'm going back to my own experience. When I created my character, I'm not going to name who it is, but when I created my character, I was reading Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber.
Yeah.
So fairy tales were much in my mind. So I was like, and as you know me, I love using fairy tales and adapting fairy tales in my writing. So I was like, oh yeah, super, this fits. And then of course, someone said, oh, you like that kind of thing. You should read The Witcher. And they lent me the book. And as well as being utterly horrified and going, oh no, someone else has already done it in such a similar way. I just fell in love with the whole way that it was framed. And the way that he played with the fairy tales, and he'd drawn from both kind of the folklore, obviously, of you know, Poland and Polish folklore, but specifically the fairy tales, which are obviously not necessarily from Poland, but have this kind of, he makes it feel like there's this very intrinsic relationship between his world and these stories. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that feeds into our previous episode, I think it's called Tale as Old as Time, whereby we were talking about how it's not so much the stories themselves or the fairy tales or the repackaging that gets people on board. It's how you present the themes, because the themes are universals. They're almost like archetypes. And it's something that Sapkowski has done really, really well with The Witcher.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It certainly explains why The Witcher ticked more of my boxes than Game of Thrones did. And I did really enjoy Game of Thrones, but somehow The Witcher hit part of me that Game of Thrones just couldn't reach. I don't know. And I was watching and I was thinking, oh my god, you know, there've been episodes of Game of Thrones like where I felt like this, but I have never felt like this through the entire series before. Whereas The Witcher, Alan and I were kind of like, oh yeah, we're just going to watch one episode a night, but we binged it in about a day and a half.
Relatable.
So it's like, oh, and we've come to the end now, and now we have to wait until 2021 before the next season. Bugger.
No.
I'm sure we'll watch it again.
Yeah. But yeah, I think you're right. There is just something charming about it. And I don't mean charming necessarily in the, oh, how charming. I mean charming in the very dangerous fairy-esque way.
Yeah, it really does get under your skin. I think, as fairy tales do, it echoes parts of the darker human experience that most of us don't really want to confront and yet have this sort of morbid fascination with.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is a very, very interesting series in that way. And yeah, I love the way he's used fairy tales. And I was particularly impressed how they managed to maintain that in the Witcher series. Because the Witcher series is actually covering a whole lot of material.
Yeah, it's basically the... I mean, the trouble is the Witcher books were all written out of sequence, which, you know, I can kind of identify with. I know what that's like. But it does mean that they sort of come out and you're like, hang on a minute, we're back here on the timeline. I'm so confused. Obviously, we're into spoiler territory now. So last warning to get off the boat. But that's something that the series, instead of trying to skip around it, it just embraced it. And for the first three episodes, you're kind of like, where the fuck are we? By the end of the third episode, you're like, oh, this is at least two, maybe three different timelines, right? And it doesn't talk down to you. It doesn't explain it to you. It pays you the compliment of expecting you to keep up. But it does sort of gamble with your intelligence and your patience with the first three episodes in the sense of, hang on a minute, how can that possibly be happening? And why is he now like this when before that he was like that? And you realise you're basically getting Geralt in different timelines, and then you on episode three, it takes you all the way back to Yennefer's backstory.
Yeah, and that was the thing that confused me, because obviously I went into it with some knowledge, and then I was like, oh, they're adapting it so that they've kind of just linked it all together, and then I was like, wait, what's happening? And also it was just that every time you go to certain stories, it was like, in some cases it would have been like a long time would have passed, and then in others I was like, Ciri has not been wandering around in the forest for years now, has she?
I think halfway through the second episode I turned to Alan and I went, seriously, is Ciri still in the forest right now? Why isn't Geralt looking for her? Isn't he supposed to be looking for her by now? And Alan was like, oh, I don't know. I got to the end of the third, in fact I think it might have been halfway through the third episode, I went, ah, you're playing with the timelines. And it took Alan an extra episode. He's like, hang on a minute, are they doing two different timelines? I'm like, dude, did you not get that in the last one?
They are doing three different timelines.
But yeah, it was fun. And that was kind of satisfying. But you've got to have a bit of patience to allow it to unfold. And I think it kind of meant that some people never really fully unpacked what that meant. And it meant that things went over their heads. So they got frustrated that... then they weren't seeing developments in character attributes in the sense of skills developing, and they weren't seeing they're used to the montage of being spoon-fed something happening, and that's not what you get is you jump back and forth along the timeline and you have to make the deductive leap yourself. And I don't think that's a bad way of telling a story.
No, I don't think it is. Obviously the other difficult thing is that at least the two of the main characters don't age.
Yeah, that also doesn't help.
Yeah, so Geralt, according to kind of their timeline, at the start of the story, he's pushing 100 already.
Yes.
And Yennefer is about, kind of by the time she meets Geralt, she's about like 70 years old.
Yeah, 70 or 80, isn't she?
Yeah, exactly.
Not that you can tell. She looks about 20. No.
Yeah. And Ciri is obviously, Ciri is kind of meant to be 11, 12 years old.
Yeah.
And obviously her story just takes the course over like a week. So there's all sorts of things happening. And in fact, the only allusion to time passing, they do it so tongue in cheek, is when Yaskia is just there like, how long's it been? Months? Years? What is time anyway?
And it's very, very funny. Okay, so, I mean, that's a little sample of what we think of The Witcher. I think we're kind of comparing The Witcher with Game of Thrones and probably one or two other fantasy series. It's not entirely fair because each of them are their own thing. but there are best comparative studies at the moment. And that's not to say The Witcher is perfect or that Game of Thrones was terrible, because neither of those things is true. But we are going to look what each sort of gets right and gets wrong, or could do better on. Could do better is a better way of putting it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to go ahead and go first, if that's okay.
Sure.
And I think this is one thing that Game of Thrones actually got right, which it took The Witcher a little bit longer to get into the groove. Which is because actually The Witcher is ultimately about these three loners, as it were.
Yeah.
There was never a great sense of camaraderie, really. And there was never really any kind of satisfying sense of the characters actually really gelling with one another. Which meant that everything felt incredibly cold. And obviously that's meant to be purposeful, but for me it also meant that there was a certain dynamic which was stripped away from the main characters. For instance, you get the whole issue of Geralt and Renfri. And for me, looking at the way that their relationship was portrayed in one episode, I just didn't get behind their romance at all.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really a romance as such, was it? It was a case of, I suppose you have to look from the perspective of Geralt being a mutated human and is kind of outcast because of that. And it's interesting because at different points in the timeline, he's more respected or less respected or not served in a tavern or what have you. Renfri herself is also an outcast. She was born under the wrong moon and all the other girls were murdered, who fell under those circumstances. But the huntsman who took her into the woods, she's literally Snow White. But instead of just letting her go, he rapes her and robs her and lets her go. And she tells you this, backstory-wise. And she's become quite a badass from there. She finds the huntsman and kills him. And obviously kills a bunch of other people who wronged her, including the sorcerer who intended to murder all these girls in the first place. But there's too much baggage on either side. And, you know, Geralt, I think, is... I know he's sort of edging towards 100 at this point, but I feel like he is also having... Because at different times he's been outcast or more in fashion, as it were, he has real difficulty forming any kind of relationship with people. I mean, there's all these rumours about witches don't feel. You don't find until much, much later, he's like, we feel like everybody else does. It's just easier for them to dehumanise us if they say that we don't feel like you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're completely right. And I also think that obviously the interesting thing about Geralt is that he's kind of thrown into a bit of a, you know, a situation because he's 100 years old. He thinks that he's kind of found a rhythm. He's kind of comfortable with where he is, or, you know, at least it's very familiar. And then this whole incident with Renfri kind of sets him spinning, I think.
Yeah, especially with how it ends.
Yeah, and it obviously has a humongous impact. But I still wanted there to be... I felt like we really didn't actually necessarily get that spark between the two characters, which kind of, even if it wasn't love, it was something, you know, more important. And for me, that felt a little bit rushed. And it was probably because, actually, in the series one, they were covering a lot of shit over an incredibly long period of time.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Which actually meant that in terms of at least the first few seasons of Game of Thrones, obviously, there was a lot more time to explore each of the characters, each of their arcs, because it developed in a slower way, which is not necessarily better or worse, but it did mean that actually when it came to the character relationships, I found them incredibly believable. Which meant that when a character a character was in mourning or when a character died, I felt it. It wasn't just oh, I guess that's happened, which initially was kind of how it felt with The Witcher. And I do think, you know, there was questions of budgeting, there was questions of how much they were trying to get in. And as I said, it's not necessarily wrong, but for me, it was just a little bit, it made the first at least couple of episodes, the first three episodes, I just felt kind of a bit, oh, I'm not really actually touching base with any of these characters in the way that I'd like to. And then, you know, things changed a little bit.
Yeah, I can't decide whether it's entirely a stylistic choice or slightly accidental. I think some of it is stylistic in the sense of, ultimately, if you unraveled the timeline and put everything in the right order, you'd have Geralt going from being very cold and I'm just a killing machine to I'm reluctantly taking on this sort of group of friends and comrades and found family. And also you do have to consider personal preferences as well. For example, we're both suckers for the found family trope, you even more than me, so you kind of want to get to that part a lot quicker than most people do.
Yeah. I'll admit it.
But yeah.
And Geralt is so against the found family, he's like, nope.
Yeah, and you do understand why, because his actual family basically sold him.
Yeah. Obviously he does have a kind of a Witcher family, as it were.
Yeah.
And a group of friends. Yeah, I just kind of missed that a little bit. And then basically Jaskier comes into the scene. And initially I found him super annoying because he wasn't quite like the Jaskier from the books.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, come on. Also, I think they were cowards because they didn't call him Dandelion. They were like, no, we're going to translate everything else, but we're not going to translate Jaskier because we can't possibly have a character called Dandelion. And I'm like, oh, cowards.
I did wonder when you sort of stopped after three episodes, I was like, did I raise her expectations too high by saying, oh, by the way, there's a total Gregory Cuthbert Chaucer thing going on here.
There really was, and I really enjoyed it, actually. Because I was rewatching. I think the problem was that, yeah, because Jaskier was one of my, or Dandelion in the books, was one character that I really did like. And I was annoyed a little bit with this incarnation of it. And then actually we got to the next episode. And I think the thing that probably annoyed me was that there was no real chemistry between Geralt and Jaskier. Whereas with Geralt and Dandelion, they're almost constantly bickering.
Yeah.
But Geralt at the same time does consider him a friend and will call him such and things like that. It does develop a little bit over time. Whereas this Jaskier he's a little bit more awkward. He's younger.
He's a bit feckless.
He's a bit feckless, yeah. And he's a kind of a tiny bit of a fumbling buffoon. And then, of course, and I was like, oh, but they just don't seem to, you know, Geralt doesn't seem to like him at all, doesn't seem to respect him at all. And then, of course, you have the next episode where Geralt is helping him out at the ball, and I was like, okay, here we go. This feels a little bit more like the relationship that I know and the relationship that I like. And it kind of went more into the swing of it from there. And I do think that Jaskier in the series provided that balance a little bit more, whereas the comedy up until that point had been incredibly dark, and he added something a little bit lighter as well, which for me actually enriched the whole experience.
Yeah, I think you're right. As much as I appreciated the dark humour, once Jaskier started doing dumb shit, basically, and having Geralt bail him out, it really got into the swing of things. Okay, other things that I think... something I think The Witcher did better than Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And that's the female character arcs.
Yeah.
It's very, very noticeable in Game of Thrones that, with the possible exception of Arya Stark, all the main female characters at some point undergo either humiliation, torture, rape, or death. And the humiliation they're subjected to is nearly always the humiliation whereby they're made to be lesser people because they are female. And that has always really bothered me. And it bothered me in Game of Thrones the way that they just throw in tons of nubile female flesh. And it's very noticeable that any rape scenes or whatever are quite titillating to watch in the way that they're filmed. And I think it really helped that they had a female showrunner writing and developing The Witcher, because yes, you do have nudity, and yes, you do have prostitutes, because let's be honest, we can't, even I've put prostitutes in my books of late, because it's just something that was historically a thing that happened. But just because somebody is a sex worker, that doesn't mean your characters have license to treat them like shit. Or to say, well, you know, they're fallen women, they deserve this, or what have you. And I think the show did a much better job of that minor character being actually given some sort of characterization. And she's treated quite well, both by her pimp and by Geralt. And then you have the other female characters. And yeah, it's kind of like the fact that they're female is neither here nor there. It's sort of incidental to the fact that they are strong characters.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think that there is an element of nuance to the female characters which isn't present in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And that's that Yennefer is selfish and bratty.
Yeah, unapologetically so as well.
Yeah, I to be honest, I never really liked her that much in the books either, and so I didn't really like her in the series. I found her to be quite irritating much of the time, but by God, does she have a very interesting character growth and development. And the only equivalent of kind of bratty or selfish characters that you get in sort of Game of Thrones, it's either beaten out of them, or they're the villain.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that's a very moralistic choice, as it were. And Yennefer, obviously, she kind of develops gradually on her own, and it doesn't come from any form of embarrassment or something like that. It comes very much from within. She doesn't have to be humiliated. She doesn't have to be raped or anything like that. She comes to this conclusion on her own over time, when she kind of sees what's happening around her and she grows in order to fit with what's happening around her. But I think the closest you can compare her to is Sansa Stark and Cersei. And Yennefer is like neither of those characters.
She's not really a bad person. She just wants her slice of the pie, and she wants it to be a big slice.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's an unlikable character, but she's not an evil character. And I think up until that point, basically, there has been, particularly in Game of Thrones, and I'm going to say that this is actually more to do with the TV series than it is to do with the books.
Yeah, that's fair.
Where in the TV series, actually, the characters who we were meant to be behind were ultimately more likeable and made more likeable. For instance, Tyrion in the TV series is more likeable than Tyrion in the books, in terms of his actions, in terms of the way that he behaves.
Yeah.
Certainly. He's very dialed down. Whereas Yennefer is actually pretty accurate, I think, personally.
From what I recall, yes, she is. I have to say, I loved her. Even when she was being annoying and making stupid decisions, her actions made complete sense to me, and her character arc made complete sense. That's not to say there aren't problematic aspects to it, because, you know, Yennefer starts off basically deformed.
Yeah.
Or deformed by the standards of the narrative of that fantasy universe. Hunchbacked and, you know, generally malformed, and
yeah,
with the unfortunate attendance that that people who do appear physically disabled and are obviously physically disabled quite often face in everyday life, whereby able-bodied people quite often treat them as if they're stupid, or if they're yeah. of less value, or if they're taking up too much space because God forbid that they should, you know, they should have a seat on the bus or what have you. You know, it's very much, there is still a pervading attitude of, you know, not seen and not heard. We'd rather you were sort of tidied away, which is deplorable. Yeah. And part of that is an inherited attitude, which kind of goes back to the eugenics movement. And lest we forget, yeah. the eugenics movement started in America, not with the Third Reich. The Third Reich copied 1920s America. Yeah. And it was prevalent over here in the UK during the 1920s too. So nobody gets to hold their head up high without blushing on this one.
Yeah, completely agree.
But I love what they do with her arc. I love the fact that she's a female character who unapologetically goes after what she wants. And she makes mistakes, and she makes the sort of slightly ill-considered decisions you might make in your youth before you understand what life's really about. She puts herself in a position where she can have anything bar one thing, and then discovers that all those things that she's been so envious of and wanted all this time, now that she's got them and can have them, everything's a bit tired because there's no genuine connection or affection or what have you behind them.
Yeah, yeah. And as I'm saying, I didn't like Yennefer's character necessarily, but I completely agree with you that everything that she does makes sense. And her development was very interesting. And despite the fact that I found her quite annoying, as I said, I always found that her at that stage of the story quite annoying. She has incredibly epic moments, and she does, you know, and her, the end scene with her kind of just blew my heart away a little bit. It was incredibly moving.
Yeah.
And I certainly feel like the person she becomes after this experience is actually one who I enjoy a lot more. So it was part of her development. So I don't have anything against that at all. And I think you're right that this is something that actually The Witcher did better than Game of Thrones.
There's a couple of elephants in the room here that we probably should just talk about. And yeah. one of them is obviously the representation of disability, which honestly neither The Witcher nor Game of Thrones has really got quite right.
No.
The other elephant stood next to the first elephant is the idea that a woman's value is down to her reproductive organs. It's very telling. This is a shorter conversation, so I'll do this one first. The one thing that Yennefer goes after is a child of her own. It kind of makes sense for her character in a way, because if you read fairy tales or fantasy, then whenever a massive magical transformation or whatever takes place, there's always a price, and the price must be something that you think is not of any consequence when you agree to pay it, and then later it becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger price. You know, that's classic fairy tale logic. You're always made to pay more than you can actually afford. It's unfortunate that it was her fertility in that respect. It kind of makes sense that when she couldn't have children, and after she'd lived 80 years, 100 years or what have you, that life is a bit dull, and maybe the only real type of love is the love that you would feel for your own child. And maybe that's what she's questing for all the time. She wants to genuinely be loved, and she wants something to genuinely love, but people keep disappointing her. So she's looking for this last thing. That's kind of how I read it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. The thing which kind of got me a little bit, and that I also felt, was that actually Yennefer also, a part of her initially wanted it because it was the one thing that she couldn't have.
Yeah, absolutely. She's always gone after the things that she's told she cannot have. At this point, we'll go to the disability thing in a moment. I would also say this is not great in Game of Thrones either, because it's very strongly based on the War of the Roses, and, you know, but weirdly it's kind of set back in sort of what is perceived to be 14th century, 15th century medieval Britain or medieval Europe.
Yeah.
Where I would like to point out women were not actually treated like this. It was nowhere near as cut and dried, so it's been very exaggerated, particularly in the TV series. It's a case, you know, the highborn women were married off in order to secure dynasties, and yes, that did happen, but it happened with the woman's consent, even if they were coached through their childhood to understand what their duty to a family was. And there were obviously those who refused to do that. It's nowhere near more plain than with Cersei, because it becomes apparent in the end that Cersei's only redeeming quality is the fact that she loves her children. Honestly, that should be the absolute base level of anyone who's a mother. It's not always the case, and, you know, sometimes it's very unfortunate that some mothers don't love their children, and that's a thing. That doesn't necessarily mean they're bad people altogether. But the fact that that was her one redeeming quality, this strong female character. Conversely, you have Daenerys, who loses her son very early on and is told she can never have children. It's all about fertility. This is very much their story arc, because they are women. You know, let's equate everything with fertility. Arya Stark turns away from it entirely. Which I kind of understand, and Sansa's traded back and forth like a broodmare before she reaches the end. And then you have, like, Brienne of Tarth, who is considered far too ugly to be married and therefore is just a virgin all the way up until Jaime deigns to take her virginity. And I have all kinds of problems with that storyline, but we won't go into that. I've talked about it before. That's a really problematic aspect, and I am amazed that Game of Thrones people never picked up on it at any point.
I think it's probably because at the end of the day with Game of Thrones, even though that was something that was running underneath the surface, it wasn't actually as prevalent, I think, in the main thing. But I think you're absolutely right, it was there. And it was always there. But I think the problem with The Witcher, and this is the problem that really, really annoys me, which is that I can totally understand saying, I want kids. And I can totally understand Yennefer and basically saying, I want a meaningful relationship with someone. And it seems to me the only way I can have a meaningful relationship with someone, the only way that I can have someone who is actually going to love me for me, is if I have a child of my own. And the problem with that is that she kind of bends over backwards doing these insane things, and getting steadily more frustrated in order to have a child biologically. And all I can think of is adopt. Just adopt someone.
Well, I mean, she does kind of try that very briefly until the baby gets shot.
Well, sort of.
You can tell that's what she's thinking. I mean, the mother's dead and the king does not want yet another daughter. And she's kind of like, well, I guess it can be my baby then. Then, unfortunately, dead. So people have really criticised her sat on the beach talking to the dead female child. And I'm like, actually, no, she's talking to herself there. She's trying to tell herself that it's okay, she doesn't actually really want this. But I think that's the moment when she really realises that she wants children.
Yeah, I think you're entirely right. I think also the thing is that she was obviously put in a situation where she had her mother, but her stepfather was the one who sold her.
Yeah.
And so she's probably going into it saying that a child who is not biologically mine, that connection will not be possible based on her own experiences. So I can understand, again, that decision to say, no, I want to have a biological child. And I can also understand that, you know, lots of people do, you know, go through a lot of things in order to have a biological child above adopting. But at the same time, it doesn't change my frustration with the fact that she could have still picked up a baby pretty much anywhere and raised it She could have raised plenty of babies, but no. She kind of does increasingly dangerous things, manipulates as many people as is possible, and kind of actually behaves relatively despicably.
Yeah.
In order to basically have a child of her own. And that for me is the kind of, is when it becomes very selfish, because she's literally willing to destroy other people's lives in order to get what she wants. She has no regard for them, and I can understand that. So that's basically the kind of the cutthroat world that she's lived in. But you realise at that point that she's not thinking, I want to create a world which is better for a child, or that I want to, you know, be a parent. It's very much about what she wants. She wants to be loved, so she's having a baby, which isn't necessarily actually on its own the best motivation towards having a baby.
No.
Her own insecurities.
This has been criticised, but I actually thought that it made a good point. And that's when Geralt's saying, you know, half the time when they sterilise us, they're actually doing us a kindness, because our children won't live as long as we will. And they're sparing us the pain of seeing our children grow up and die. I mean, yes, that's misguided in a way, because it's taking the choice away from somebody. But at the same time, there is a genuine point there. And I think there's also the case of, no matter what you do, you are in a position where you are going to constantly be in some form of danger, or you are going to draw fire. And you don't really want to have children in that sort of scenario, simply because they're hostages to fortune.
Yeah, exactly. And then Yennefer's like, oh, and then you're just... Yennefer's argument with Geralt was like, and now you're just stealing children instead. And I was, again, that was the bit that got me, because Yennefer's like, oh, it's all good for you, Geralt, but you, apparently, you have a child just waiting for you. And I'm like, Yennefer, at any time, you could have also done the same thing. Why are you getting so high and mighty?
You could have had a small army of them by now. You could have opened your own college of mages.
Yeah, she literally could have.
So, the other elephant in the room, and that is the disability rep for both Game of Thrones and Witcher, and obviously numerous other fantasies. We're not just picking on these two. I can completely understand the person who got very, very sweary on Twitter over the fact that you had a visibly disabled Yennefer, and then she goes through the transformation whereby she loses her fertility and gets made beautiful. My only caveat there is, yes, that really sucks. That really sucks, and it does feed into the whole idea of, you know, it's not, I think we're still sterilising certain disabled people up until 2007 in America. We were forcibly sterilising disabled people in the 1920s in America, and to a certain extent over here too, in particular homes and asylums. So yeah, those two things kind of, that's, you know, you're disabled, we don't like looking at you, so we're going to change how you look and take away your how sterile you are, not sterile, how fertile you are, or take away your fertility. That's a bad narrative for it to have fallen into, but I don't think that was deliberate. I genuinely think it was falling into the fairy tale thing of, it's going to cost you, you want this and it's going to cost you, and you don't think it's going to cost you very much, but later you're going to realize how much you've paid.
Absolutely.
I also think it kind of makes sense with Yennefer's character at the time, who, she was incredibly ambitious, she was driven, she was embittered about everything in her life. She'd been pretty much thoroughly rejected, sold by her family, constantly bullied and put upon, and, you know, just genuinely treated very, very badly. She wasn't even treated that well when she went off to learn to be a mage, even though she turned out to have a lot of talent. So, and then the final blow is the fact that they took away the land that she was going to be sent to as a representative. You know, it was taken away by a prettier, better connected girl. Yeah. And I kind of applaud the fact that she put herself through this huge, painful procedure and went behind everyone's backs to put herself in a position where she could take what she wanted. I don't think she was right. But I'm kind of like, yeah. I can't help but applaud somebody who is that determined and willing to fulfill their ambition.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, you've got a point there. And as you're saying, I don't think that it was on purpose. I think it was much more to do with fulfilling that fairy tale trope. But it was a little bit thoughtless. And I think they kind of tried to touch on that with it. Initially, Yennefer does reject the change. And then she's sort of goaded into it because she's kind of made to realise that she can't get what she wants unless she is physically changed.
Yeah.
And then that physical change is something that she later regrets.
And I think it's worth... Yeah, I mean, she gets to look back when she's talking to Istrid much later on. She's finally looking for that connection, that love with somebody. And he's saying, why me? You could have anyone. And she's like, yeah, I have. It's good fun for a while. But, you know, it's not the same as forming a genuine connection with somebody. And it's like, I've gone out, I've had my fun. But obviously she quite harshly rejected him, and he threw some very cruel words at her as well. And that was very sad. That was two people who were very angry and frustrated and embittered about various different things, who had some real affection for each other. And I guess the thing to realise is, yeah, they got together while she was still, you know, physically malformed, as we're told in the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, had a romantic and sexual relationship, which didn't, you know, the fact that she was disabled didn't get in the way of any of that. So in some ways, that was quite positive.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a difficult one.
It is.
It's a very difficult one. And it does have some uncomfortable parts to it, which I can totally understand people getting very angry about. I don't think those were intentional, but it's unfortunate, particularly in this day and age. We must also compare when it was initially written to when it is, you know, done now, and just people's general awareness of issues and topics like that. Again, that doesn't make it right. It just kind of, you understand where it might have come from a particular standpoint.
Yeah, we're not trying to excuse anything here, and we're certainly not trying to repaint everything because we both loved the show. That was an unfortunate aspect of it. That's something that can be done better, and I hope future fantasy shows do take those things into consideration. I will say that I preferred it to how Game of Thrones dealt with disability. On a few issues.
Yeah, well, on the one issue, there was no real case of disability being fixed. Which is that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Tyrion doesn't stop being a dwarf. Bran Stark doesn't get the use of his legs back.
No, you know, but it does,
or anything like that.
It does kind of become his superpower, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, it does. But I mean, it's more along the lines that that injury was the thing which led him to where he was now. So it was part of a journey, but it's not necessarily that he has it because he is disabled. It's that. Because he was injured in that way, he pursued a particular journey which gave him these powers.
And it's things like, I suppose it's things like, they abandon him being able to ride horseback quite quickly, when in fact they had a perfectly good saddle and trained horse set up. So that was annoying, because that's a case of, well, you know, chairs and you know, properly trained horses and saddles and things. That would have been a good thing to show that it needn't completely impact his life. Now, I realised that would have possibly ruined the story arc, so... okay, I kind of see from there. But I think it was really kind of driven home in the final episode when it was even with Tyrion saying who has had a better story than Bran the Broken. First of all, Bran the Broken, there's got to be half a dozen other things he could have been called. Secondly, are you saying that his journey was... you know, amazing because he was crippled? Because on one hand, that's really patronising.
Yeah.
And then you have Sansa saying, oh, but he can't father children. And I'm like, okay, bitch, you don't know about nerve endings. That's not how it works. So, yeah, that bothered me. And, yeah, I think with Tyrion, and again, we've got this fantasy... we've got this fantasy landscape whereby everybody expects people who are different and disabled, whatever, to be treated badly, which wasn't necessarily always the case in medieval Europe, etc. Just like gay people weren't always persecuted. Sometimes it was just tolerated and everyone minded their own business as long as you weren't king. Women weren't always told to shut up and just bear children again.
Yeah.
There were more freedoms. So I suppose it bothers me from a historical viewpoint that it only shows this one thing. And I am talking primarily from the TV series here.
Yeah. The Bran the Broken thing was very jarring for me. But I kind of... I went back to it from the perspective of the books, which is that Bran and Tyrion have this... do kind of have a bit of a relationship in some way, where basically when Tyrion sort of finds out about Bran and that Bran's woken up, he stays around with Bran for a little bit.
Yeah.
And he kind of, he's the one who helps design the saddle and stuff like that. You know, there's this camaraderie in Tyrion saying, hey, I am, you know, disabled too, in the same way, not in the same way, but, you know, we're kind of, I understand where you're coming from. I understand that now we are both physically different, and I'm here to tell you that it's not the end of your life at all.
Yeah.
And of course the whole thing with Tyrion was that he said he was basically about owning your own body, your own disabilities, and because then no one can ever insult you.
Yeah.
And so the Bran the Broken thing, for me, when I reanalyzed it like that, had more of a connotation of this was a kid who everyone kind of wrote off, and yet here he is now as king. The problem is that that actually took a lot of context and a lot of kind of like twisting around in my head in order to be understood. Which for me means that it's not necessarily successful in terms of just adding it right at the end of the series.
Agreed. Like, and also there's the big question of should, in the same way that I don't think Sansa should have been queen just because she was a rape survivor, I also don't think Bran should have been king just because he happened to be in a wheelchair. And I don't feel that the show adequately foreshadowed either of those things. So that was my real problem. It made the thing jarring, and I found that kind of a condescending thing to present to the reader, or what viewer in that instance.
Yeah, I mean, I felt there were so many more reasons for why Bran... You could have argued about Bran being king.
Yeah.
And you could have foreshadowed it. And it just wasn't done. So what happened is that we were kind of put into the state, into this kind of idea, which is that he's the worthy king and should be king because he's disabled. And look how representative we are being. And because he has this particular power, which kind of makes him a psychopath, which would actually really realistically make him a better advisor than an actual king.
Yeah.
But I guess they're all also turning from the point of saying, well, he doesn't actually want anything. But if you also don't want anything, then you don't necessarily care about anything.
Yeah, that seemed to be... Anyway, there are all sorts of issues there with how that ended in that respect. And you could have sold me on everything, probably, but you needed to set it up right, and I don't think they did. But I'm going off topic a bit here. Work to be done on the disability representation front. Other forms of diversity, I thought The Witcher probably did better.
Yes.
You can... I know there was initially a big kickoff because they were initially considering putting an Asian girl in as Ciri.
Oh, I did not know
that. It's just something I read. They were considering casting an Asian actress, and a lot of people went, oh no, because it did the typical, oh, that doesn't fit my head canon thing. That's the same as when we had a black Hermione and a black Little Mermaid, etc., etc. I kind of like the casting choice they went with, but not because she was white, just because she seemed to fit the role quite well.
Yeah, she did an excellent performance, I think.
So, yeah, they could have... I think they possibly could have got more ethnically diverse main characters in there. Having said that, the actress who plays Yennefer, I don't know what her ethnicity is, but I don't think she's just... I don't want to tread on anything here, and I didn't look it up beforehand. But yeah, you could have probably definitely had more Black and Asian actors. Yes, I know it's Poland, but it's also a fantasy world, so...
Yeah, because like last time I checked, Poland doesn't have elves, actual elves. Well, I mean, I don't know, yeah. Maybe they are. But you know, it's...
If you can have Strelkin and beasts and shapeshifters and witches, yeah. You can definitely have an Asian princess. That's not yeah. That really shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, because it's not actually Poland, is it?
No.
It's just...
But what I did like was the casual casting. Amongst the casual casting of people who were in extra roles or minor roles, you had a lot of Black and Asian and varying ethnic actors just in yeah. there, and it wasn't a big deal. It was just a case of this was treated as if it was normal, and I think that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. Particularly also because, you know, they didn't kind of have to shift it away from the original story. It was just a, well, this is a usual thing. That's not to say that, you know, that there is a balance, I believe, in storytelling, which is that simply casting, you know, a Black person in a white person's role isn't necessarily the answer to end racism.
No, I think that we need more roles for Black and Asian and other ethnic minority actors.
Yeah, and I think that a part of that is also actually discussing their, you know, their identities as a Black or an Asian person. So it's not just about erasing that either. But I do think in terms of how they did The Witcher, it was nice to see a slightly more diverse cast. I would have basically liked to actually see some representation in terms of, you know, LGBT characters, though, which they didn't really have. And they did have them in Game of Thrones, but obviously it was a bit different. But
I don't think it was greatly done in Game of Thrones either,
no,
to be honest.
It wasn't, but at least they were there. It wasn't done well, but but they were there.
While we're talking about, yes, you're absolutely right, that was a very glaring thing for me in The Witcher, that there was no LGBT type rep at all, even though I was kind of reading Jeskia as bisexual all the way through.
Oh, yeah,
but that was clearly me.
No, it wasn't just you. I think basically everyone I've spoken to was like, oh yeah, that's some big bisexual energy there. Oh, and yeah, sorry, you were right that the actress who plays Yennefer, Anya Chalotra,
yeah,
she's from a British Indian family.
I thought she was, but I didn't want to say without checking. So I was just going to have a little sneaky look now, but you've got there before me. So yeah, okay, that's great. That's a step in the right direction. You've got one of your three main characters who is, you know, she's not playing a British Indian person, but she is obviously a British Indian actor. So great.
Yeah.
I think the answer, when we were talking about there need to be more roles specific for particular ethnicities, that doesn't mean that when you hire Black actors, they should be playing slaves or freed slaves, which again is kind of a Game of Thrones thing.
Yeah.
And some of those characters were great. Missandei and Grey Worm, they were brilliant characters, but it was a tiny bit cringeworthy at the same time.
Yeah. I think that you're right.
Particularly as they then came to just be supporting what amounted to white Hitler, female Hitler.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantasy Hitler.
Where have we seen that before?
Yeah.
Certainly, I don't think that we've solved the racial issue.
No.
I think in terms of actually, at the very least, allowing actors of different ethnicities roles on screen, that's good. But actually, providing nuanced roles is still something that we need to to explore and really kind of do better. But yeah, I do think that in terms of the LGBT representation, even if I totally read Jaskier as being bisexual, who I think pretty much everyone I know is just like, yeah, that's big bisexual energy. I don't like the fact that we never actually really necessarily saw evidence of it, apart from his, you know, star eyes every time he looked at Geralt.
Yeah, I mean, if you could have, he's a big flirt anyway. So
yeah,
there is no reason you couldn't have just had him casually flirting with another bloke in a bar at some point.
Yeah.
You didn't necessarily have to change the entire plot. But I do also agree with the perspective that shoehorning representation in is not the best way of presenting it either. So
no.
It's a tricky one to balance. There is a forthcoming BBC America, I can't believe I'm saying those two things together, BBC America adaptation of Terry Pratchett's Guards series of Discworld novels called The Watch. And I obviously haven't seen it, and I don't want to sit here and bitch about it. I'm honestly not sure at this point that I'm going to watch it, because from some of the decisions they seem to have made, both in casting and in the look of the set and things and where they seem to be going with the storyline, they're not inspiring me as a group of people who actually understood what the novels were, which were fantastically diverse and asking all these really difficult questions. They're not really showing me that they understand what they're about, so they haven't inspired a lot of confidence. This is kind of the tick box representation that killed Discovery. I don't want to see that. I want to see really good representation whereby it's almost not representation, it's just reality.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think the issue is that ultimately, because there's such a massive lack of representation, there's no way that any one TV show can get all representation right. There's no way that any one TV show can tick all the boxes, because you're limited by the characters, you're limited by the story that you want to tell. And I think the only way to kind of really make it better is to have a wider rep just in general, because we cannot expect one TV series to perfectly sum up the experiences of thousands, millions of people. And for someone who goes, oh, thank God we just had a very nuanced character who just happened to be black, there's going to be someone saying, yeah, but their identity as a black person was never even explored, whereas I want their identity as a black person to be explored. Similarly, I know that I watch things and I suddenly go, why can't it just be gay? And then at the same time, I will see examples where people have just made a character gay, but
That is the entirety of their character. It's like,
yeah,
they don't actually give them any character. This is the thing that I've got a real issue with. It's a case of, well, we want a non-binary character. Excellent. But that should not be their entire character. It's like, we want trans characters. Great. But that cannot be their entire character. Do they like flowers? Are they a kind person? Are they intelligent? You know?
Yeah, there's so many other things that go in with it. But I also think that, so you can have that, you can have the extreme of, right, I have the token gay character whose attribute is the fact that they're gay. And then you can also have the thing that's like, oh, so we've just made them gay. And I'm like, but what you've essentially done is you've got a straight character and you've just said they're gay.
Yeah.
And you haven't actually even touched on, you haven't actually looked at what it means to be gay, and you cannot just say it's gay but it completely in straight clothing, and forgive that, I don't mean physical clothing, but I just mean that, you know, the way that people engage with their sexuality is not, cannot come from the, you know, from the simple expected norm binary, you know what I mean?
You can't do it without exploring whether the universe you're setting it in is accepting of those differences, or whether it makes, adds extra pressures to someone who wants to pursue a relationship with someone of the same gender. You know, you have to touch on those things. That should be part of your world building.
Exactly. And or even, you've also got to consider the fact that the way that these relationships kind of progress and the way that they're, you know, that they go forward is not going to be the same as a relationship between a man and a woman. It's each going to differ, and it'll do as much to do with the character and their individual as it is to do with their sexuality. And again, I think, and I draw on this all the time, so I'm sorry I'm very boring about it, but I always think about the relationship between Holt and Kevin in Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and the way that they are both, that they balance the fact that their sexuality has obviously had an impact on their lives, and the way that they've, you know, they've lived their lives, but it's not their defining feature. And I think that that balance has been struck very, very well, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah.
Okay, moving away from the diversity train for a moment, if I can still talk. Just a quick one on world building before we then go on and talk about very briefly the fantasy series that we'd actually like to see adapted for TV later. So world building. One criticism I've seen leveled at The Witcher is the fact that they don't feel the world building is very defined. Honestly, I think it's as defined as it needs to be for an epic fantasy that has its roots firmly in the old and grim fairy tales.
Yeah, I do, however, feel like the problem is that they catered it a little bit too much toward fans of The Witcher already.
Possibly, yeah.
In that I do feel like actually there's a lot of stuff which you don't really get unless you've actually got that background in the lore and the world already. That's not to say it can't still be enjoyable, but I do feel like they could have fleshed it out a tiny bit more, particularly because it is actually an incredibly rich world.
And it's possible we might get some more of that in the next season as well. Yeah. And as more fans get on board, because I'm sure the series has drawn in far more fans than before, then I think they'll cater to the greater numbers as well. I think you have to admit that Game of Thrones does a fantastic job with world building. You can't really pick holes in that one.
No, certainly not. But Game of Thrones is also significantly larger in terms of the world.
Yeah.
You have the whole beginning sequence, which is just all of these places.
It gets longer and longer as you go along. I love that. Who doesn't love the opening credits to Game of Thrones? Seriously, it's amazing.
It is amazing. You know, they've got all these places and their characters are kind of spotted all around these places. Whereas I never really had a great sense of exactly where physically Geralt was at any given time. And that did mean that we never really had to worry about things like, oh, how long did it take to get X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, that was very convenient.
We didn't have to worry about anything like that. And also they're like, oh, Nilfgaard are doing this, that, and the other. And I'm like, I don't know where they are. I don't know how long it's reasonably going to take them to march from one place to another, you know. So we didn't have to answer any questions like that. But I do feel like also there was a little bit of a sense of pretty much everywhere that Geralt went was a bit samey. And that wasn't actually the case in terms of the setting. You know, you see Ciri turning up to certain places and going to certain areas, and there is actually this great, there's this sense of, you know, different places, different areas, and even different climates. Like, there's that one bit where she's in the woods with these, you know, with this whole other culture, and it was so brief, and I was like, wait, no, this looks awesome, what the hell is going on here? And it was like, no, we leave now. And I was like, no, let's stay here for a few episodes. Really kind of want to understand what the hell is going on. So I do feel like, again, it was because they were trying to get so much into a number of episodes. And Game of Thrones has the advantage in that, you know, it took them an incredibly long time and they had significantly more character points of view to take you further afield. So.
Yeah, very definitely. Okay, well, there's no real conclusion here because this is not a competition of who did it best. It's a case of which one resonated best for you. I really enjoyed Game of Thrones, and I would honestly say The Witcher resonated best for me, despite a few flaws, and I hope to see, you know, better in future as well.
Yeah. Whereas for me, I think, apart from particularly the final series, Game of Thrones probably still resonated better with me on some levels, but The Witcher has kind of scratched an itch that I've always had, and I really, really did enjoy it. And I do suspect that actually as the series continues, it may very well be that The Witcher overtakes Game of Thrones for me.
Right, so at the moment there is a mad scramble by producers and studios to option or sign non-sale rights of various different fantasy franchises. So, for example, Mark Lawrence, who wrote the Broken Empire trilogy and various other trilogies, has had several of his trilogies optioned and also has been asked, you know, can you just agree not to... This is kind of a shitty thing to do to an author, by the way. Has had studios saying, we're interested in making your story. We want you to sign this contract to say that you won't sell it to anyone else for a period of 5 years. And then you say to them, okay, but what are you offering me money-wise not to do that? And they're like, oh, no, we're not. It's just we want you to promise you're not going to sell it to anyone else. And all of these companies are buying up as many of these properties as they can or getting these contracts signed. And they're not necessarily compensating the authors, so that's a bit crap. Obviously, you don't have to sign them. You can just leave your rights where they are. And if it turns out that yours could be the next big thing, then... you're probably better off waiting for someone to genuinely option it, because even if it doesn't get made, you will get money for having it optioned. Not a lot of money, but some money is better than none.
Yeah.
And of all of these things that are being optioned, there are things like the October Day series, the Wayward Children series for Shannon Maguire, and various other bits and pieces as well. So this is a case of what would we like to see fantasy series-wise, epic fantasy series-wise anyway, for the next big Netflix thing. This is wish fulfillment.
Yeah, complete wish fulfillment. Okay. So, look, I'm just going to go ahead and say because obviously, actually, we've already technically, we've got the Netflix series for Six of Crows and the Grisha World, so... That's already on its way. But I would love to see a TV series of The Gentleman Bastards.
I had a feeling you might say that.
Well, I just think it would just work so well, don't you think?
If they inserted quite a few more female characters, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like...
It's a bugbear and I can't quite get over it. I'm sorry.
That's fair enough.
But then these adaptations only really need to be true to the spirit and the essential outline. They don't need to be true to everything that happens. So maybe there are characters who die who needn't get killed off, and you know, they could produce something where I'm like, okay, my last reservation has been melted. So I'm so nervous about the Six of Crows Grisha universe one.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how they develop it. Certainly, I think that if this is pure wish fulfillment, they brought me in to help with kind of doing if they said, oh, Madeline, you should come and help us with the Netflix series of Gentleman Bastards, I'd be like, right, so Nezca's not going to die. You're going to keep Nezca alive, and she's going to take over when Kappa Barsavi dies, and she's actually going to be in on the whole thing and stay and take over his kingdom while Locke and Jean run away, basically.
Yeah,
I would totally have that, and her being like, well, you're gonna have to go because you've broken the peace and stuff like that, but you know, I'll let you escape with your lives, as it were. So I would have done that in a TV series, but yeah, I see what you mean, but it is something I would love to see. And I am actually, I'm interested, I'm a bit worried about Six of Crows, mostly because they're combining it.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that kind of makes me go,
I'm like, oh. I'm not, okay, it's the same universe, definitely, but the timeline's completely different. So yeah. I'm like, ooh. Okay, so it's kind of a bit of a freefall thing. My wish fulfillment one is actually one that has been optioned and apparently is in production currently, which makes me super nervous and super excited, and that is the Kushiel's Dart series. Now, whether they'll actually go through with that, considering how BDSM heavy it is, and we're talking on-page heavy BDSM type stuff, and it being presented as a very positive experience, I think that could be quite a hard sell, but I would love to see somebody pull it off. No pun intended.
Yeah.
No, I would genuinely love to see them accomplish that, because that series has a lot to say about sex positivity and freedom, slavery and emancipation, about respect for different ethnic diversities. There is political intrigue and war, and then this fantastic fantasy world building of, you know, basically fantasy France, whereby the reason they're all so beautiful is because they're descended from angels. So there's a lot there that you can do something amazing with. I'm just so nervous that people are going to go, oh, you've got a woman being tied up and whipped, and it doesn't matter that she consented to it. This is pushing the Me Too movement back, when in fact it's not necessarily at all. So
yeah, and it would also depend how they actually frame that.
Yeah, definitely.
Because there's the possibility that it could be made weird and less than consensual, or you know,
yeah,
just in the way that it's filmed. So you would need a good director, really, to do
that. I mean, nuance is everything, and there's no point saying that some of it isn't going to be titillating, because, you know, it's kind of written in a way to be titillating, but not just to men, to anyone who's got the vaguest interest in that direction, or who just wants a romance a fantasy which has quite a few steamy bits in it which are actually relevant to the plot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I do have some more ones which I'll wish fulfillment.
Yeah, go for it.
Completely. Yeah. So, there's two here, and I'm unapologetically just going to say I really, really want both of your series.
Neither of which is epic fantasy.
No, I know. But I do feel like, in particular, I would love to see The King's Knight done into a miniseries, because I just think it would work so superbly well as a miniseries. You know, as a TV series. It would just work so well, Jules. Come on.
I
know it's not epic fantasy, but I'm cheating, but I had to put it out there.
I think it's okay, trying to be unbiased here, because obviously I've written it. Yes, in a way it could, because I wrote it to be quite visual. And because I had less space word-wise, there's not so much description, so you're getting a lot of the information directly through the character's viewpoint. So in that respect, yeah, possibly it could work. On the other hand, I'm like, oh my God, what would I be like if somebody ever managed to convince me to part with the rights to that? Because I think I would be like, you know, a nervous, expectant parent. And, you know, I would not be very good at being hands-off and not having an opinion. I mean, talking about The Witcher, I don't know if you've read Sapkowski's interview where they're trying to get him to say what he thinks of the TV series or the games or anything. And he's kind of like, well, you know, I wrote the books. I didn't write everything else. It's not up to me to have an opinion about those. I sold the rights. I sold them to people who knew what they were doing. And it's kind of like, how are you that laid back? Seriously? I would not be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even George R. R. Martin was very sort of...
They're touching my baby!
Yeah, and then I just think of Rick Riordan, who just flat out was like, yeah, the movies of Percy Jackson were terrible.
So like, but I sold the rights, and, you know. As for Unveiled, I've had several people contact me and saying, I would love to see a series of this. And I'm like, that's completely out of my power. But in some ways, yes, I would love... I mean, there is an ego thing involved, definitely, because I'd kind of love to see the characters brought to life. But I am also more than half convinced that if they didn't cast how I've got them in my head, I'd be kind of quite put out by it as well. Yeah. Like, if they set it in America instead of the UK, I'd be really fucked off.
No, yeah, that couldn't... You couldn't do that. That wouldn't work, in the least.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to see an adaptation of the Harshier Cycle, because there's a lot in there, and it's got that fairy tale feel of The Witcher to it as well, and it sort of draws on myths and legends, and there's plenty of subplots, which I think if you've got a big epic fantasy series, then that makes it ideal. And, you know, we just kind of need the third and fourth book now. Hint, hint.
Don't come at me like this. But yes, I do think that I would love it for it to be a series. And I think it would work better as a series than as a set of movies. Because, as you say, there are a lot of characters. I would love it. I would really, really love it. But I would so be very sort of like, I want to be part of the whole process.
It's like, I must be involved in set design and location choice. And obviously you cannot be all things to everybody. And same with your book as well. You cannot fulfill every single role. So I'm genuinely interested, if anyone's listening who happens to have managed to sell rights and have something made, how did you manage to let go enough, you know? I'm very excited about finding out how people feel about that, because I think I would be dreadful.
Yeah. I think it would be very, very difficult, and I don't think I'd be able to let go entirely. I think I'd be like, look, I want to be part of the process, at the very least, at least so that I can come in and just make sure that they don't erase any of the rep. That I just be like,
yeah, that'd be...
you better not be making it anything less than 100% queer.
I mean, that would be a big thing for me as well, particularly with Unveiled, although, you know, there is queer rep at the moment concealed in The King's Knight. But that would really annoy me if certain characters are suddenly made straight, or certain characters were suddenly whitewashed, or what have you.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. Oh, right. Now that we've put our wishes out into the universe.
If you happen to own a production company in a film studio, we're taking requests. But also, go and make things like Kushiel's Dart and The Gentleman Bastards, because we want to see them.
Oh, I seriously want to see them. I'd be so excited.
You'd have to do it absolutely right so it fitted with our headcanon, by the way.
Yes. And on that note, we are coming to the end of the episode. But before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And I think it will come as no surprise to anybody that we are recommending The Witcher. That's actually, upon, you know, second thought, not necessarily the best recommendation, because if you have listened to this episode, then it's been full of spoilers. So hopefully you've actually already watched The Witcher.
Or at least you're one of those people who doesn't mind spoilers.
So if that is the case, do go and watch The Witcher, do recommend it to other people. And do let us know what you thought about it, particularly if you've come from the background of never having touched any Witcher content at all, or if you've come from the background of having played all of the games. Leave us a comment, let us know. And on that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast. Thank you.